bringing you the truth behind the news. Welcome to The New American.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Paul Dragoo. We're glad you joined us. I'm here in the studio with my colleague, Steve Bonta, who is the executive senior editor of The New American Magazine. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Paul.
So we're going to look at a couple really strong stories today. And for the first time in U.S. history, a U.S. president is facing criminal charges. Now, you would think that maybe it'd be any of the ones who sent soldiers overseas to these senseless wars, or maybe be the guy who in the 90s gave military secrets, right? Or military capabilities to the Chinese. Or what about the corps in chief now who has a trail of evidence suggesting that he sold influence, right, to China and many countries? But it's not. It's Trump, right? And is this where you
Well, just for the record, I assume you're being rhetorical. I would never think that any of those other people would be held to account for their deeds because they were all acting in lockstep, in accordance with the agenda of the elites who seek to control us.
Yeah.
So in their perpetuation of endless war and interventionism overseas, in their deliberate subordination of American foreign policy to the agenda of the globalists, in their continuance of outrageous, you know, kleptocratic tax and inflationary, monetary policies, and on and on and on. However criminal those acts may be in the great cosmic scheme of things, in the here and now,
yeah,
those people are all acclaimed and upheld. Even Bill Clinton, who at one time, I mean, old enough to remember, you know, the depths of the Clinton administration and the nauseatingly corrupt scandals there. But today he's upheld as this sainted figure from the 90s. Oh, yeah, there were a few sex scandals, but let's not talk about that. You know, things went just hunky-dory. Bottom line is he delivered the goods to his masters, and so has every other president in my lifetime and yours, except for one.
And that's Donald Trump.
It's this guy who wants to.
Right. And what is this crime? His crime, apparently, I guess it's some sort of error in bookkeeping, falsifying documents, I guess, is the official crime, right? And it has to do with this hush money. The whole thing has got quite a few layers to it. It goes back in days. And we're going to look at a timeline of that. But yesterday he showed up in Manhattan in court there. And apparently he was so concerned that he fell asleep. We're gonna roll a tape here from a New York Times reporter talking to CNN about how concerned Trump was.
Yeah, I have to ask. You guys have been live blogging this event, and 40 minutes ago, you wrote an observation that I was very surprised. Trump appears to be sleeping; his head keeps dropping down, and his mouth goes slack. Tell us about that.
Well, Jake, he appeared to be asleep, and, you know, repeatedly his head would fall down. There have been other moments in other trials, like the E. Jean Carroll trial, which was around the corner in January, where he appeared very still and seemed as if he might be sleeping, but then he would move. This time, he didn't pay attention to a note that his lawyer, Todd Blanche, passed him. His jaw kept falling on his chest, and his mouth kept going slack. Now, sometimes people do fall asleep during court proceedings, but it's notable, given the intensity of this morning and a lot of what was being argued.
Yeah, that's rather surprising.
Now, I don't think the Trump campaign has released any statements as far as why he was falling asleep. I like to think that...
Trump has denied that he fell asleep.
Oh, okay.
And he's quite angry about this. And in as much as there's no video footage, several of the reporters are making this claim. It's probably fair to surmise. Of course, the press is absolutely jubilant about this.
It was all over the place.
Yeah, they've been giggling away about, oh, finally we're going to have, convicted felon Donald Trump and on. Just constant schadenfreude out there in all the supposedly unbiased media, which, of course, we're going to talk about the unbiased media a little bit later today.
Yeah.
But in any event, it's just a disgusting show of media-driven partisanship. And of course, part of that, as it has been from the beginning, is to try to make Trump look like a total fool. Now, in fairness to the establishment media, Trump sometimes does himself no favors in that regard.
Yeah.
But in this case, he is, despite his age, I mean, he's no spring chicken any more than Biden is, but he's, unlike Biden, very, very high levels of energy, only sleeps a few hours a night, constantly on the move. You know, apparently even his young aides in their 20s and 30s have trouble keeping up with the guy.
Yeah.
So he's probably bored.
That's what they said about Biden.
Well, he's probably our number one concern here should be that these court proceedings literally bore the man to death.
Yeah.
You know, because he's not used to being a man of action. He's not used to this, the slow, plodding, incredibly, you know, dull Brobdingnagian proceedings associated with, you know, courtroom, in particular courtroom in Manhattan. I can't imagine, you know, quite aside from the peril of actually, oh, I don't know, going to jail or whatever else they're going to try to throw at him, you know, just sitting in a courtroom. I've sat in a courtroom a couple of times in my life, and they're really dull.
Well, it depends
they waste
on the
your
years,
time. This is ultimately, it's a government, I mean, it's like going to apply for a new driver's license or anything else. It's a government organization, and it behaves like government. So small surprise, yeah. Trump is a fish out of water.
Yeah. Well, and here, let's look at what he did say, but when he is awake, as far as what he thinks of the trial. Can you roll that, Kyle, please?
If you read all of the legal pundits, all of the legal scholars today, there's not one that I see that said this is a case that should be brought or tried. It's a scam. It's a political witch hunt. It continues, and it continues forever.
It's kind of like we said, it is. There's no way I think that history is going to be kind to this. Now, so what is going on? Right now they're picking jurors, right? And they say that could take up to weeks as well, right?
Yeah, well, it turns out that that at least in this, the ultra-libs of Manhattan are being honest. Apparently, scads of jurors, more than 40 jurors already, or 60 jurors, large number, are saying, I can't possibly be impartial. Code for, I hate this guy so much, mm-hmm. and I want to see him put away and hung in irons and, if possible, flayed alive so much that there's just no way that I can be a partial juror. So at least they're being honest there. Mm-hmm. Now, Trump and his team have been trying to get this trial moved to a less hostile venue like, say, Staten Island, which, of course, it's the one part of New York City where some semblance of political sanity apparently is still to be found. Mm-hmm. I've been to Staten Island a few times. It doesn't really resemble the rest of New York. It kind of looks like a larger version of Appleton here. You know, it's just a kind of
working town.
A large, small town, a lot of working class people and that kind of thing. So Trump feels that he would get a fair shake there.
Yeah.
Of course, that's not the plan. The plan is to make an example of him, to publicly destroy him. And they feel that the best venue to do that, to accomplish that, is in Manhattan. It is truly, as he said, a witch hunt. The problem with witch hunts is that, you know, they don't work so well if you're in an area where people just don't care so much, don't have the fanaticism of colonial Salem or something like that, which is what we're seeing here in Manhattan, mutatis mutandis, with regard to Trump and the whole MAGA movement.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine a more hostile environment other than, say, Berkeley or some other parts of California, maybe Chicago. There are a few small enclaves in this country where Trump and everything he stands for are absolutely hated and repudiated.
With
a passion that couldn't be exceeded, even in the likes of communist China or North Korea, quite frankly.
Yeah.
I mean, and so that's what Trump is up against.
Absolutely.
You know, and they have no intention of letting him out. It doesn't matter if it takes them, you know, a month just to find those 12 jurors who profess to be impartial and honest. They're going to do what it takes. They're going to keep it in Manhattan.
And they want to keep them off the campaign trail.
And keep them off the campaign. Obviously, the longer this drags out, also, I assume, you know, he'll have weekends still to go out and do his rally thing. But,
and apparently Wednesdays, I think.
Wednesdays. Yeah, yeah. I don't know what they're going to do. But obviously, the longer this drags out, perversely, given that even if he's convicted, which he will be, okay, he's going to be convicted on these various non-crimes. Yeah. He will be convicted in this trial. They will probably try to put him in jail or some such. You know, that's the plan. But it will be appealed speedily and eventually be overturned. But it's going to take a big chunk out
of
his campaigning season.
That's the point, though.
And the moment this one's over, they're going to move on to another one. So this is going to be relentless throughout the rest of this year.
That's the point, is to keep them engrossed in that, away from the campaign trail. But I don't think it's going to work. You know, I think this kind of stuff, as we saw with all the indictments, right? Every time a new indictment came out, his popularity went up. He surged in the polls. And I think people are going to continue to see this for what it is. And so even though he will be kept off the campaign trail, he's winning bigly. He's still ahead in polls. Now they say Biden's coming up and whatnot, but I just don't see this working. You had an interesting take while we were talking off camera, is that the best thing the Biden campaign could do is pardon him, and that would be their best move. That was pretty interesting.
Well, yeah, and I mean, probably have to carry this over to the next segment, but suffice it to say that Biden, he has some options here. But it's not just about what the people want.
Yeah, get into that neither. We're gonna continue this conversation right after this.
Imprisonment, forced labor, permanent separation from my family, perhaps death. I knew what could happen to people who were caught trying to defect. But the watchtowers stood yards away. The possibility of a new life in a different world, one without tyranny, was within sight. The West. I thought of the rewards no longer crushed under the boot of communism. I would work and make money, no longer restrained by the chains of collectivism. I would say what I wanted, without fear of spies and informants nearby. I would be free. The frozen rain and Romanian mud seeped through my gloves and cloths. I fantasized about a fire burning in the wood stove of my parents' home, but I pushed those thoughts from my mind, closed my eyes, and waited for the cover of the darkness.
Get Defector, a true story of tyranny, liberty, and purpose by Mark Hobovkovich with Paul Dragoo, a thrilling page-turner that will remind you how precious yet vulnerable freedom is. Available at shopjbs.org or Amazon. For a limited time, get 20% off your entire order using promo code DEFECTOR20 when you purchase Defector at shopjbs.org.
All right, so we're back. So, Steve, we were talking about the best move that Biden can make, which would be to pardon Trump.
Yes, absolutely. Perversely, if Biden were to come out, of course, I don't know if his powers of presidential pardon would extend to something like this. Yeah. It's pretty local. I mean, he's pretty much already, they've unleashed the beast, and they don't know what to do about it anyway. So I don't know that he could actually do that even if he wanted to. But if he could, you know, perversely, that might well deliver because there are a lot of people out there who are looking for a reason not to support Trump because, frankly, he's not always the most likable guy in the world. You know, he does himself no favors with the mean tweets and all the rest of this. And while they may be inconsequential in the greater scheme of things as against, World War III or the impending collapse of the dollar and all these other things that have been begotten as a result of the current feckless administration, the fact is that it still matters to people. You know, they want to have a president that they feel in some sense a relatable, you know, connection with.
Yeah.
Okay. So if Biden were to suddenly come out and do take the high road and say, you know what, we've had enough of this. We just want to have I don't want anyone to ever say that I didn't beat him fair and square. And I may not agree with him personally, but this is ridiculous. And just set it aside. He could well win the election. Now, the real issue, you know, pursuant what you were saying in the last segment is, oh yeah, this is going to continue to generate more and more and more popular support and sympathy for Trump. Doesn't mean he's going to win the election because, as we've remarked before,
they're going to cheat.
It's not. Yeah. Well, I mean, the question is not who is going to be elected, but who will be installed next January. I mean, Biden has been installed once already, and I think there's at least a 50-50 chance that a similar scenario could attain again this year.
Yeah. I want to go through a quick timeline to show what a scam this is. And you may be familiar with this, but this is thanks to James Kunstler. He kind of put this together. So check this out. So Daniels met Trump in 2006 at a celebrity golf tournament. I don't know if you knew that.
Stormy Daniels.
Stormy Daniels, yes. But there was no Stormy Daniels news until 2016, of course, in the presidential primaries. And she apparently got $130,000 in hush money payment through Michael Cohen, which was Trump's attorney. By 2018, though, through her California lawyer, Michael Avenatti, who's now in prison, Trump they tried to invalidate this non-disclosure agreement. In December 2018, she lost a defamation suit against Trump and was ordered to pay him $300,000. 5 years later, she was ordered again to pay an additional $122,000 to cover his legal fees. By then, Avenatti was in jail for embezzling client funds. Now, apparently there's letters by Stormy, and I guess some of them may have ended up on the internet, where she admits that she hadn't even had sex with Donald Trump. And then apparently the Southern District of New York office of the DOJ and the Manhattan DA then, Cyrus Vance, they both had already tried to do what is happening now. And it wasn't until 2020, till, like we said, Biden is installed, and all of a sudden Trump announces his run, that the Biden DOJ aligns itself with Alvin Bragg, who Trump mentioned yesterday. This guy, you know, he's got criminals going around killing people in New York, and this is his major, right. This is what he's going after. That's when all this blew up.
Well, I mean, you know, this has been broadly characterized by every legal expert under the sun as the weakest of all of the cases. And they're all weak, okay, against Trump. But this is the weakest of the weak.
Yeah.
So weak that the federal government, in fact, declined to go after him on these terms.
Right.
The cast of characters, you know, a former porn star, a lying sleazebag lawyer who's now in prison.
Mm-hmm. Tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah, who are expected to be the witnesses. Now, I mean, on the other hand, I think it is pretty clear.
By the way, it's not illegal to pay someone that hush
money. No, it's not.
That's not what this is about.
But I mean, just to be clear, I mean, we're not making the claim that Trump is some sort of sainted figure. Back in the day, you know, he did have something of a reputation of a playboy. In fact, he writes about in his book, Making a Deal. He talks about one of the perks of having lots of money is waking up in a penthouse apartment with a beautiful woman lying beside you. Words to that effect.
Yeah, we know he was a scumbag that. He was a philanderer, yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, like probably a majority of rich and powerful men, you know, that's has been one of his weaknesses. I don't know whether it is now, you know, if he's, you know, is as much of a tomcat as Bill Clinton was. But here's the thing. There was a time when sexual improprieties were viewed as consequential. And so when they were known about it, as was the case with the Kennedy, everybody covered up, you know, the press all knew what Kennedy was like. Everybody in Washington knew about it, but it was covered up because it was understood the American people would not have been happy if they'd known that, that Kennedy was, you know, sleeping with all these movie stars and even an East German spy and all this type of thing.
Okay, so that
was covered up until after he was conveniently dead. Fast forward into the 90s, of course, Bill Clinton was not so discreet. But they insisted at the time, did the Democrats, when they finally got, you know, when they got caught and were held publicly accountable for this sort of thing. Oh, this doesn't matter. It's the economy, stupid, and the American people don't care. Well, now they're reaping what they sowed, because nobody wants to hear about, you know, Trump's alleged peccadilloes, true or not, okay? Because, you know, people with any kind
we
of
become desensitized say, are to
you,
that.
Wait a minute. Are you the Democrats, the same people who stuck up for this, for the lying, cheating scumbag Bill Clinton, you know, fell on your swords for that guy a generation ago,
right?
And for other people, you know, similar people like that, you're now suddenly you've seen the light and you've decided, oh, this is unacceptable. Of course, technically, I realize that it's the charges are about, you know, misrepresenting on tax forms or lying about
bad bookkeeping,
all this garbage. But this is such trivial stuff.
Yeah,
you know, it's very plain what they're doing with this, and it speaks volumes again of the utter morally bankrupt hypocrisy of the Democrats and the deep staters in general, that they stand in solemn judgment of Trump for this kind of thing.
And
once upon a time, also with Clarence Thomas a long time ago, lest we forget, that's kind of how this whole thing got started, actually.
Yeah.
But, you know, they bend over backwards to airbrush all of Clinton's crimes and lies and everything else, sexual and otherwise, from the annals of history. You know, it's just, I have no patience for these people. So we'll see. But that said, I mean, you know, Trump is in a pickle right now. He is in hostile terrain. He's not in flyover country anymore with people who actually care about him. He might as well be in a cage in Beijing, China, you know, at this point.
Yeah.
So we'll see how things go for him.
Well, let's look at our next story, because this all plays into how we perceive things, the way that, you know, we mentioned the media. So on the show, we've done quite a good job at criticizing, lambasting the media. And I think we've done so for good reason, because they deserve every bit that we dish out along with everyone else. But today we're actually going to look at a story, and we're going to look at actually what happens when journalists in mainstream media actually try to commit real acts of journalism. So last week, two veteran journalists testified before the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Constitutional Limited Government. They always have such long names for these committees. Anyway, so these journalists testified about the problems that they incurred for reporting about government misbehavior. So I think we have enough time to run this clip from House Judiciary Chairman Jim Jordan talking to Cheryl Atkinson and Catherine Herridge, both of whom were former journalists at CBS. Let's roll the clip.
Ms. Atkinson, you wrote stories critical of the Obama administration. Is that accurate?
Yes, but may I point out it wasn't put in a political light, and there were also stories that some would consider critical of the Bush administration.
Well, let's say it this way. You wrote stories critical of the government.
Yes.
Yeah. You factually reported. And then you did on Fast and Furious. You did on Benghazi and other issues.
Yes.
And even before, as you said, on the Bush administration. And then strange things started happening to you, right?
Yes.
Yeah, like a computer you think it, your phone gets bugged, you believe, and things happen to your computer after you wrote stories critical of the government.
Right.
That's scary, right?
Yeah, it's not a frightening everybody. Feeling, right.
Ms. Herridge, you wrote stories critical of the Biden administration. Is that true?
That's fair.
I mean, you wrote a number of things about the laptop issue, about Hunter Biden, all kinds of things. You wrote critical of the Biden family, the Biden business operation, the Biden brand, and all that stuff.
Congressman, I reported out the facts of the story.
You sure did. You sure did. You reported the facts. And then CBS fired you. Is that right?
My position was terminated.
But it's worse than that, isn't it? Because they didn't just fire you. What else did they do?
On February 13th, when I was told on a Zoom call that my employment was terminated, I was locked out of my emails and I was locked out of the office. CBS News seized hundreds of pages of my reporting files, including confidential source information. When the network of Walter Cronkite seizes your reporting files, including confidential source information, that is an attack on investigative journalism.
Yes.
When my records were seized, I felt it was a journalistic rape.
We're going to be right back to continue discussing this story.
Hey, America. How tired are you of mainstream corporate media's biased narratives and manipulated news? Their dishonesty and attempts to influence this generation have been exposed, put on display for anyone who's even half paying attention. But the New American Magazine has been an honest source of news and commentary for over 50 years. This is your opportunity to receive the stalwart of principled journalism at a deep discount. Picture a beautifully published magazine arriving at your doorstep twice a month, packed with insightful stories written with integrity. It's also available digitally on the New American's mobile app. Get up to speed with intelligent coverage from a freedom perspective. Right now, for a limited time, The New American is available to radio listeners at a 25% discount on a new subscription. Visit thenewamerican.com/radio25 and receive 25% off. Subscribe today at thenewamerican.com/radio25.
All right, folks. So we're back. We just watched clips of Catherine Herridge and Cheryl Atkinson. They were both former CBS reporters, and they have both been canned. Cheryl Atkinson resigned from CBS years ago. Herridge here was canned, as she described. And, oh, Steve, you look like you want to jump in.
No.
Oh, you were taking a deep breath.
I was trying to present
it. Yeah. So, okay. Now, Herridge, I do want to mention, she did get her files back. Now, she is actually being held in contempt. This is the story has a lot of layers to it. She's being held in contempt for supposedly violating some sort of privacy act. She did a story when she was with Fox back in 2017, I believe you read the story, on someone with alleged Chinese military ties or whatever. And apparently what had happened is the story was leaked to her by someone perhaps in the intelligence agencies, because the FBI had investigated the story. So that's kind of how she ended up in this mess that she is now. She may be in now. Now, she's also talking about a bill. There's a bill that's in the Senate that originated in the House, and it's supposed to be a bill that protects journalists who want to protect their sources the same way that we're protected on the state level. I actually have some experience with this. When I was a journalist in Montana, I had been interrogated by police because someone had dropped off internal files from a federally qualified clinic. And so what would happen is this person who had worked there, they dropped off these files, a big stack of files, and they were telling me, look, there's mad corruption. And this is important because, one, this is mostly taxpayer subsidized, and they're backdating. They're not taking care of patients the way they are. They're not addressing their care. They're not even making them appointments when they should be. Again, this is all on taxpayer dime. So I looked through all these documents. But nevertheless, the police called me in because I guess the person who gave me the documents was not allowed to give me those internal documents. I guess they were considering them stolen. Anyway, long story short, we had called a media lawyer who was kind of always represented reporters in Montana. His name was Mike Malloy. I had talked to a national union or some sort of media advocacy group. And so they were ready to kind of defend me. They're like, they can't do that. You know, it's like, if they come after you even more, let me know. But this is not, so this is kind of, it seems like Catherine Herridge, this is kind of the situation that she's in, but on a greater scale, because she is being bullied by the federal government. So she wants this bill passed that originated in the House. It's called the Protect Reporters from Exploitive State Spying Press Act, and it's H.R. 4330. We have a clip of her discussing it.
This legislation will provide protections for every working journalist in the United States now and for the next generation. The legislation provides strong protections at the federal level for reporters and their sources. It would block litigants and federal government from prying into a reporter's files, except when there's an imminent threat of violence, including terrorism and in defamation cases. At the state level, similar rules are already in place to protect press freedom. It is my sincere hope that the passage of the Press Act will provide similar protections at the federal level. I hope that I am the last journalist who has to spend 2 years in the federal courts fighting to protect my confidential sources.
Steve, you know what's interesting about this bill is you have Jamie Raskin, who supports it. And later in the clip, we didn't obviously play the whole clip, she talks about how she's hopeful that Chuck Schumer is going to put this on the floor. They'll get this signed since it's already passed the House, and then the Senate, and then it'll go to the Biden desk. So I find that interesting because I'm going to watch to see what happens with that. But what do you make of this entire thing?
Well, I mean, there won't be any ironclad guarantees. There are already, for example, legislation that protects whistleblowers in the government. And we see how they just run roughshod over that. They go after them anyway. So, I mean, it's not going to stop altogether the government's reflexive, you know, desire to suppress information and to punish people who traffic in information that they don't want made public, things that, of course, are damaging to the government. So I expect that will continue, and they will find ways, you know, that they may put loopholes in it. I don't mean to sound unnecessarily cynical, but this is something that's been going on a long time, almost from the beginning of the Republic, even though we have very prominently spelled out in the Bill of Rights, the freedom of press not being infringed. That's pretty much all the government has done.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we jailed, journalists in the Civil War period and World War I and, World War II. All this type of thing. It's persecution of journalists.
But it's
nothing new,
unfortunately. But it's especially bad today. And you know what? You're right. Because it's like when you look at the history of journalism, if you just look at, especially in the U.S., journalism, as it was called, newspaper, used to be partisan, right? You had like the Arkansas Democrat or whatever. And then there was this period where you were led to believe that they were impartial. You know, I got hired by an editor who was a raging Democrat, and he had read stuff that blogs I'd read wrote for Red State, whatever, and he didn't care because he thought that I was able to commit, you know, objective journalism. So there still is, and you can see in Harris, she's probably a Democrat, we don't know, but she was trying to commit objective journalism, and this is what she gets.
Well, yeah, and I'm assuming probably both of them are Democrats. It must have been painful at some level to sit there and realize, wow, it's guys like Jim Jordan, Republicans, the enemy that's actually sympathetic to my cause. Although Raskin, of course, is a Democrat, so, you know, one never knows. He's, I guess, the proverbial broken clock that's right twice a day.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But, you know, it seems like every so often we need to have some sort of a shakeup. you know, the last time this happened was back, you know, the Pentagon Papers and all of that, you know, the all of the stuff that went on with the Vietnam War coverage. Yeah. And
the New York Times was on top of that.
Well, yeah. And I mean, today even as we speak, you know, they're still trying to extradite a foreign citizen, Australian citizen, you know, Julian Assange to the United States to get him here so they can lock him up forever for daring to release, you know, news stuff, doing what journalists do, in effect. It's absolutely blatant persecution. Yeah. And not only that, he wasn't even in the United States. How can you accuse the guy of espionage? He's not an American citizen. You know, this type of thing. So, you know, so this continues apace. And I, you know, hopefully something will be done of it. But the fact is that as long as there is government, the profession of journalist, true journalist, I hasten to add, not these shills for the deep state masquerading as journalists that dominate the establishment media landscape in our day. True journalists. Well, as Matt Taibbi only recently found out as well, will always be a hazardous profession.
Exactly. This is a reflection. This is a reminder what happens, you know, when these journalists try to actually be journalists. I want to go to Shara Atkinson's because she doesn't get a whole lot. She didn't get a whole lot of playtime here, but she wrote a book called Slanted. And I think she wrote another one, but I read Slanted anyway. And this was back some time ago, a few years back. And she writes about how critical stories get killed. It's very important to realize how this happens. So she was at CBS. And one of the examples she gives is she wrote about Solyndra, which was Obama's solar panel boondoggle. And she's talking about how in 2012, she got a tip from unions who were saying, hey, this bill pays for like lots of Korean workers. It's not actually very good for American workers. She had an interview with a union leader. She had photos. She had the whole story, right? And guess what happens? It gets killed by an executive producer in New York at HQ. And she's saying this happens all the time. So she gives us a glimpse of why we don't get the stories we deserve to hear from the mainstream media.
Okay, well, I mean, I don't know if we have enough time to really go over any history of this, but more than a century ago,
We got a minute, Steve.
There was a man named Walter Lippmann who wrote a book called Public Opinion. And in that, it's very easy to find. You can find it online. You can read it fairly quickly. But Lippmann himself was a journalist, and he argued somewhat plangently that there's no way that the media, the news media, as then constituted or now, can possibly cover everything that happens because the plenum of existence and of events is just too dense and too complex. So they have to make choices. They have to say, well, we think this is a story worth covering. Okay, so that much is true. Obviously, you have to select stuff, and that's the job of an editor to determine what is and is not newsworthy. What's happened, and I think we all feel the difference, even though it's impossible to quantify it, is that at some point we've verged over from making those judicious selections about what is newsworthy into full-blown advocacy and propaganda. And that, by the way, was something else that Lippmann felt would be a good idea for government going forward.
Thanks, Steve. After this, Veronica Karolinko joins me to talk about her interview with Ron Johnson. We'll be right back.
If Americans want to remain a free and sovereign nation, more people need to understand the principles and values that built this great nation. At the John Birch Society, we have the organization, the plan, and the resources to do just that. Our founder, Robert Welch, said, "Education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon." Go to jbs.org to learn more, including how you can get involved to work locally and impact nationally. Join the John Birch Society today.
The New American's Veronica Karolinko, senior editor here at The New American, recently interviews Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson. And Veronica joins us now. Hey, Veronica.
Hello, Bull. How are you?
Good, good. So that was a smashing interview there. I mean, obviously the content is pretty, it's gloomy. And, we journalists, in a way, we're kind of like vultures sometimes. We get excited about this stuff. But I think what's exciting about it is that Ron Johnson is fully red pilled, it sounds like. I mean, the things he talked about, and we're going to talk about some of them, are things that are true. And it's a good sign in the sense that you have someone of his stature talking about things that really matter and talking about these things that really matter that you're not necessarily allowed to talk about. There's a lot in your interview. Part one is already available and part two is coming out today. And we're going to talk about that too. But you know what? I found some interesting things in there. And that was the talk about the vaccine schedule. I know that we've been talking about the injections, the COVID injections. You've done a great job covering that. You've got, you know, interviews with some of the top dogs as far as the lies that they told us about that. But one of the things I found interesting is now it seems that it's coming to the surface, and I want to get your thought on this, about this vaccine schedule. This is something that I know, like RFK Jr., he's been on it, his advocacy group is. But now we're talking about 50 doses of vaccines, whereas Ron Johnson mentions is you used to get very few. So does it sound like now we're veering into territory where we're not just discussing the COVID injection, but we're talking about the possible harm of vaccines in general?
Yes, Paul, you're right. But those are not 50 doses of vaccines. Those are actually up to 90 doses of vaccines that American children are advised to receive by the age of 18. So 17 different vaccines, totaling 90 doses. Yeah. And that's a huge jump from three doses that Senator Johnson received when he was a boy, right? And he said that he's just 69. So he said that he never was an anti-vaxxer, and he implied that he trusted the healthcare regulators. But then for him, like for so many other Americans, the pandemic response was a hard slap in the face. It was such a rude awakening for him and for so many others. He realized that the government was utterly corrupt, and it put zero value in the well-being and very lives of people, to be frank. He mentions the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1966, which granted legal immunity to vaccine manufacturers for injuries and deaths caused by the CDC recommended childhood vaccines. And yeah, this is crazy to think about. Why do you need a liability for something that is safe and effective, right?
But right.
Yeah, this is how we operate. This is how the CDC operates.
Well, mm-hmm. And speaking of the CDC, another thing that you guys mentioned is the fact there's the statistic that 6 out of 10 Americans have chronic illness. And this was in that conversation. And Ron Johnson, again, brings up a point that you would think that all legislators who are elected by constituents to represent their interests would bring up. 6 out of 10. That's more than half, Veronica. Why aren't they investigating this? I know you don't know that.
That's a wonderful question. It's like, why not? But before we get to that, I would like to point out what at the factors that the CDC puts the blame on for this epidemic of chronic illnesses, because this is unthinkable. We're the richest nation in the world, and yet 60% of our people are chronically sick with at least one condition. This is nowhere near normal. Should be like that, right? So they say it's tobacco use and exposure to secondary smoke. They say it's poor nutrition, physical inactivity, and excessive alcohol use. And while this is true that these factors can cause chronic illnesses, they are nowhere near being prevalent in America to make 6 out of 10 people chronically ill. And in fact, Paul, if you look at the numbers pre-pandemic, if you look at tobacco and alcohol consumption, they've been steadily dropping over the past decades. At the same time, physical activity has been on the rise. Well, that's before the pandemic hit. And that leaves us with poor diets. And that's certainly a very complex issue. And one needs to consider the dietary choices of Americans, but also food quality, the use of pesticides, which are absolutely toxic and linked to chronic diseases such as diabetes and cancer and reproductive damage and so on. And that problem is linked to the fact that the government is captured by big agro. You know, it's not just big pharma, it's huge corporations that are taking advantage of the agencies that are ripe for corruption, Paul.
Well, I'm glad. I mean, I wish we had more time. We're going to have to get you back on tomorrow, because I used to cover agriculture, and I would talk to farmers. I talked to conventional farmers and I talked to organic farmers, and learning all that back and forth. I talked to a guy who's a scientist and a farmer, and he does studies in Italy and Canada, and he does them in Italy because there's certain things he can't do here. And he, you know, that's where my eyes lit up as far as the food we eat. But like you said, it's like smoking. I watch some of the old movies and my son will watch him, and my son's been kind of really propagated, and he'll see someone smoking and he acts like they're you know, dancing with the devil or whatever. And I'm like, relax, kid. It's like, it's not the worst thing. But you're right. Smoking has gone down. Alcohol use has gone down. Everyone's running now and stuff like that. You see them through the neighborhoods. And poor nutrition is, I think, very valid. Now, I with the last few minutes that we have, I want to talk about Ron Johnson's view as far as the way that our government is. You know, he said something, he said, you know, the government is completely out of control. And then he talked, you guys talked about the global elites and how they're only, they're, all they want is power and control. And I think we live in this unique system of control, because on the surface, for most people, kind of things seem fine. But the moment you get out of your lane, where, you know, the moment, you know, there's a threat that the foreign policy will change, immigration policies will change, fiscal recklessness won't necessarily, or maybe we can start changing what we put in our bodies. That's when you start running into obstacles, or maybe you may be skewered, or, you know, blackballed, or things like that. So it's nice to hear that he gets it, but we have to help the rest of America realize that we're not as free as we think we are.
We're not. Obviously, we're not. And Senator Johnson, he was very clear about that. He said American government has morphed. Well, I'm actually rephrasing. It's not a direct quote from him, but he implied that our government has morphed into a monstrous Leviathan that is A, way too large to be effective. It's way too costly. It consumes a lot of resources. It's ripe for corruption. It's subverted, like you said, by the globalist elites. And finally, it is simply dangerous, since the agenda looks to destroy people's rights and liberties and make them more more obedient to the whims of the government. And the elites, exactly. But the good thing, Paul, is that there is hope, as we discuss prospects for justice and accountability and strategies to defeat globalist agenda in the realm of information and education. He covers it in depth, so you will not be disappointed.
Well, can you give us a little sneak peek there? I mean, he's working with a lot of people who I know that he's friends with, for instance, Robert Malone, Dr. Malone. And so there's this group, this cohort, this global cohort who is the opposite of the elites, and they're bringing attention to it. So he's part of that. Is there anything else that he's that we can look forward to in this interview? A whole lot,
well,
right?
Yes. No, he talks a lot about how global elites maintain their power and control. And he says that they do it by controlling the narrative.
Yes.
They push their own agenda.
Yeah.
Okay. But at the same time, their own interpretation, they decide what is facts and what is fake.
Mm-hmm.
And they suppress the dissident voices.
Yeah.
That contradict these narratives. And well, this is why he says it is so important to get the truth out. And he thanked our magazine and other alternative outlets that are actually not afraid to speak up and sell people the truth as it is.
Thank you, Veronica. We look forward to talking to you again about this, and great job. And you can watch the interview at thenewamerican.com. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of The New American Daily. Remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. And we'll see you tomorrow.